Christmas is a time when you eat too much, drink too much, and eventually get to Christmas. You're not thinking too much, is my guess. We're now sufficiently far away from Christmas, about 3 weeks, that I figured today I could ask you to really think. Because what I'd like to do is introduce you to some giant ideas that I've been thinking about for years and they still make my brain hurt. 40 years. I was 20 years old when I became a Christian, and 40 years ago, and you don't need to be a rocket scientist to work out, I just turned 60. I was living with a mate, like in a group house at the time, and he wasn't or isn't still a follower of Jesus. And when I tried to talk to him about it, he asked me this question. He said, "Okay, you want me to believe in God, but I can't see him, touch him, hear him, taste him. Where is he? Like, what do you want me to believe in?" And I remember thinking, that's a good question. Okay, now that's a slightly less sophisticated version of what you have on your seats. When you came in, there was an A4 sheet. On one side of it is a picture of an older man and a couple of explorers walking through the jungle. The older man is Anthony Flew. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's kind of his star has kind of faded. Anthony Flew was, I guess, the equivalent of the Richard Dawkins of the 20th century. He was an outspoken atheist, would debate Christians, was a scary man in terms of philosophy and what he knew, etc. And I remember second half of the 20th century, his name was around a lot. He wrote, in 1950, he wrote one of the most famous theological or philosophical papers of the 20th century called, it's on the top of the sheet there, Theology and Falsification. And he starts with a question, a more sophisticated version of what my friend asked me. Let me read to you the beginning of the paper. If you want to read this paper, by the way, it's online. You Google it, you'll get PDF, no problem. Here's what he says, how he begins. "Let us begin with a parable. It's a parable developed from a tale told by John Wisdom in his haunting revelatory article, Gods. Once upon a time, two explorers came upon a clearing in the jungle. In the clearing were growing many flowers and many weeds. One explorer says, 'Some gardener must tend this plot.' The other disagrees. There is no gardener. So they pitch their tents and set a watch. No gardener is ever seen. But perhaps he is an invisible gardener. And so they set up a barbed wire fence. They electrify it. They patrol with bloodhounds. For they remember how H.G. Wells, the Invisible Man, could be both smelt and touched, though he could not be seen. But no shrieks ever suggest that some intruder has received a shock. No movements of the wire ever betray an invisible climber. The bloodhounds never give cry. Yet still, the believer is not convinced. But there is a gardener, invisible, intangible, insensible to electric shocks, a gardener who has no scent and makes no sound, a gardener who comes secretly to look after the garden which he loves. At last the skeptic despairs. But what remains of your original assertion? Just how does what you call an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener differ from an imaginary gardener, or even from no gardener at all?" Now, if you're not a believer, you may be reading that thinking, yeah, that's a good question. And if you are a believer, you may be reading that thinking, oh, that's a good question. Okay, it's very well put, isn't it? It's interesting. The Gallup World Poll Organization, they poll people in 163 countries around the world. The stats show they estimate 95% of people that they've polled believe there's something more than just the material, a belief in some kind of a God. About 5% of the population they survey say they're atheists. And people believe in God or don't believe for different reasons. Some people will intuitively look at the beauty of a sunset or a baby that's born and say there must be a God. And others will see the suffering and injustice in the world and say there can't be a God. Now, there's been something interesting happen in science in the last 50 years. And I've got to fess up straight away. I'm not a scientist. I remember sitting year 8 in high school and staring at the blackboard, and Mrs. Miller, our science teacher, walked in, started to write equations on the blackboard, and the screensaver went on in my head. I'm trying to catch up. What scientists are finding, though, and particularly the physicists, is that there's a whole series of forces in our world that are absolutely fine-tuned that make human life possible. and that the smallest variation in this fine tuning would mean that human life was not possible. A book that discusses this, Martin Rees, who's not a Christian, not religious in any way that I know of, just six numbers. Now, he lists six different forces in the universe that physicists have discovered with the slightest variation would mean that human life is not possible. There's one about the difference. Okay, here's got you've got the non-scientist trying to explain it. The difference between the power of gravity for attraction versus the electromagnetic force that holds atoms together, the difference in the power of those is something like 10 with 36 zeros. If it was, and that's a very, very big number. He goes on to say, if it was any less than that, human life would not be possible because stars couldn't have existed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, it's so unlikely that scientists have now begun to say, well, it's like we've won the lottery again and again and again and again. If someone wins the lottery five times in a row, you think, oh, well, someone's fiddling with the numbers. And so they've come up with the idea of the multiverse, okay, so that there's an infinite number of universes maybe that we just won the lottery. Alternatively, Paul Davies, who, as far as I know, is not a Christian, or I'm not sure what he believes, but he says this, scientists are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves. For 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have been quietly collecting examples of all too convenient, quote, coincidences and special features in the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life and hence conscious beings to exist. Change any one of them and the consequences would be lethal. Fred Hoyle, the distinguished cosmologist, who certainly was not a Christian, once said it was as if a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. Now, very interesting. Anthony Flew, who had been perhaps the Western world's leading atheist, read all of this, looked at all of this over a generation. And in 2008, he wrote a book called There Is a God. In the book, he says he's not convinced by the multiverse theory. He says, it's like saying to your school teacher, a dog ate my homework. And she says, I don't believe you. So you say, it was a whole pack of dogs ate my homework. Still, she's not. Anyway, what does he say? He says, I now believe that the universe was brought into existence by an infinite intelligence. I believe that this universe's intricate laws manifest what scientists have called, quote, the mind of God. I believe that life and reproduction originate in a divine source. Why do I believe this, given that I expounded and defended atheism for more than half a century? That's a pretty good question, I think. The short answer is this. This is the world picture as I see it that has emerged from modern science. In fact, my two main anti-theological books were both written long before either the development of the Big Bang cosmology, i.e. the world had a beginning, or the introduction of the fine-tuning argument from physical constants, sometimes called the anthropic principle. That's what the book Six Numbers is about. But since the early 80s, I had begun to reconsider. I confess that at that point, atheists have to be embarrassed by the contemporary cosmological consensus, namely that the universe had a beginning. I must stress, he says, that my discovery of the divine has proceeded on a purely natural level, without any reference to supernatural phenomena. It has been an exercise in what is traditionally called natural theology. If you're interested in reading a little more from a person with faith about the anthropic principle, this idea of fine-tuning, John Lennox, God's Undertaker, he's a professor of mathematics at Oxford, and Roy Williams is a lawyer here in Australia who's written God Actually. So God's Undertaker, God Actually. We'll walk you through some of those arguments from a believer's point of view, if you like. But with Anthony Flew, the point is he doesn't go any further than that. He just says, science has convinced me there's an intellect, a giant mind, a creator of some sort. But he doesn't go any further. Now, what's all this got to do with Christmas? I finally get to it. Christmas is about the idea of, can you actually know the mind behind the universe? Can you know this supreme being or intelligence that's created the world we live in so that human life is possible? That's what Christmas is all about. Now, I want to talk to you about John's Gospel. If you flip over the A4 sheet, the beginning of John's Gospel is there. There are four Gospels or four accounts of the life of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And each of them begin in a different way, a different place. They each have a different, how could I put it, a different camera angle on the life of Jesus. So, for example, there's only two out of the four tell the Christmas story, the birth of Jesus. Matthew's Gospel, Matthew is perhaps the most Jewish of all the Gospels. He begins with the genealogy from Abraham right through to the person of Jesus, and then he tells us the Christmas story, the wise men turn up, King Herod, all of that Christmas thing. Mark begins the Gospel with Jesus at the age of 30 or so, and he steps out of nowhere and begins to change the world. Luke begins with the birth of John the Baptist, who was Jesus' cousin, but Luke then goes on to tell the birth of Jesus from Mary's point of view, if you read it. And John, the one we're going to look at for a moment, John begins not with the birth of Jesus, but in eternity before creation, before anything is made. All right. Now, what you're holding there is sometimes called the prologue to John's Gospel, verses 1 to 18. So how do you think about that? Well, I guess it depends what you're into. If you're into classical music, think of it as an overture. Okay. If you like to read academic essays, think of it as a synopsis. If you're in business, and I guess you're all here in CBA, if you're in business, think of it as an executive summary. If you're into sport, think of it as a highlights package. There you go. I've got a highlight package there of lawn bowls, which actually statistically is the most dangerous sport in the country. There's more people die playing lawn bowls than any other sport. Anyway, or if you're into the movies, think of it as a movie trailer. Okay. So whichever of those five you think of, what is he going to do? He's going to tell you what's important and what you need to look for on the way through. Okay, as you look. So let's do that. Let's have a look at it. You see where he begins? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. The idea of Word and speaking is very important in the Bible. So in the Old Testament part of the Bible, God creates through His Word. God says, let there be light, and there's light. God said, let this, you know, the creation, as it's explained, is a series of God speaking and things happen. And then God reveals Himself through His words. After all, that's how you get to know a person, isn't it? They have to speak to you, to tell you about themselves. And the way to be in right relationship with God is to trust His words. So that's the Old Testament idea of the Word, or in fact, the whole Bible idea of the Word is very important. But it seems that John's Gospel is written particularly with the Greek culture, which is very dominant at the time, the Greek culture and Greek philosophy in mind, because that word, well, here we are, I think I can say this clearly, that word, Word, is actually the Greek word logos, okay, logos. And for the Greeks, that's a loaded word. He's saying, in the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God. What does it mean? Well, Paul Barnett, who is a lecturer in ancient history at Macquarie University, in his book that he wrote about John's Gospel, says this. He says, the Greeks also referred to the Word or the Logos. The Stoics held that God had a mind, Logos, that God implanted within the universe so that it acted logically. And in the recurring daily sunrise and sunset and the predictable return of winter and spring. See, we take that for granted, don't we? That the sun comes up each day and there's summer and winter and et cetera. And it used to rain, that sort of thing, okay? The plants and the animals have seeds of the divine logos explaining their orderly behaviour. John's Greek readers would have been immediately engaged by the majestic opening words about the logos, the Word. John's dramatic introduction of the Word at the beginning of his book would have seized the attention of the Jews, who were used to the Word in the Old Testament, and the Greeks, who understood that. Now, we still use the logos idea today. So, logos to mean understanding or study. Bios, the Greek word for life, biology, the study of life. Yeah? Theology, theos, God, ology, study, knowledge, rationality, theos, ology, theology, study of God. Criminology, the study of crime. Zoology, the study of going to the zoo. Okay. All right. Now, do you notice how he doesn't stop there? See verses 3 and 4. He says, the word, the logos, this mind was God. If you want to understand, this is God himself and he is personal. See verse 3. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him, notice he's not saying it, in him was life. And that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So John writes, and I'll try and motivate you to read John's gospel. He writes in a lot of metaphors. So light, what does that stand for? Well, truth and knowledge and life as opposed to darkness, like lies etc. Right? Lies and evil. All right. Now we finally get to Christmas. I haven't got time to go through the rest of this beautiful part of the Bible, but see what he says in verse 14. Here is what he's saying about Christmas. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The theologian's word for what he's talking about here is the incarnation, which means to become flesh. He's saying in a time and a place, in a little town called Bethlehem in about 4 or 5 BC, God himself, the Word, became human and lived with us for 30 or so years. And John's saying we saw it. We saw his glory, grace, generosity, truth, etc. He's saying God became one of us. Now that is a massive claim. And the flesh idea, well, real, human, and vulnerable. Greg Sheridan, the overseas editor for The Australian, wrote an article about Christmas in 2016. Let me read just a little bit of it. He says, for Christmas, as traditionally understood in Western culture, is the most radical event in human history. The claims of the Christian religion which center on Christmas are the most stupendous that have ever been made, namely that Jesus is God. No other historical figure who founded a significant religion has ever made this claim. Therefore, as Christians used to point out, there are only three possibilities for Jesus. Either he was a deluded fanaticist or a profoundly brilliant charlatan, or indeed he was and is God. One of the best ways to try to understand the cultural and historical import of Christianity is actually to read the Gospels. John's Gospel, by the way, is one of the greatest works of literature in human history. In many passages, John refers to Jesus as, quote, the Word, and begins his Gospel thus, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, why believe this? Well, when you actually look at the life, the teaching, the death, and the claimed resurrection of Jesus, you see that there is something very, very special happened here. Why believe it? Well, the New Testament's claim is that it's anchored in history. Where are we here? I know, I have to go back. I don't have it. I only got this book this week. It's not hard to check out the historical reliability of the New Testament events and the Gospels. So here's one, Can We Trust the Gospels by Peter J. Williams. He's a scholar from England. And he'll walk you through who wrote the Gospels, when they were written, how do they intersect with other non-Christian histories of the time, etc. It doesn't take too long to get a handle on, are we actually dealing with real history here or not? Okay, but there's still a question, isn't it? All right, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son. And what I should have said to my friend who asked me when 40 years ago, where is God? I should have said, well, he turned up. He turned up in the Middle East about 28 lifetimes ago, and if you'd been there, you could have seen him, touched him, listened to him. You could have seen him crucified. You could have seen him rise again. And then my friend would have said, "Yeah, but I wasn't there. How can I know?" And I would have said, "Well, good question." Anthony Flew, a similar issue. He says, "How, it might be asked, do I as a person respond to the discovery of an ultimate reality that is an omnipresent, omniscient spirit? I must say again that the journey to my discovery of the divine has thus far been a pilgrimage of reason. I followed the argument where it has led me, and it has led me to accept the existence of a self-existent, immutable, immaterial, omnipresent, omniscient being." Generally, we would say the word God, okay? He says, "Where do I go from here? In the first place, I'm entirely open to learning more about the divine reality, especially in the light of what we know about the history of nature. Second, the question of whether the divine has revealed itself in human history remains a valid topic of discussion. You cannot limit the possibilities of omnipotence." But that is as far as he went. I don't know what happened after the book. He died 2 years later. I don't know. But the claim of John's gospel, Jesus' claim, his followers' claim, is that you can actually know God through Jesus. You can know Jesus in knowing him, you'll know God. Have a look at verse 18. Do you see the last verse on the quote there that I've given you from John? John says this, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." God the Son, Jesus, has made God known. And you'll know him through his words. And so you get to the end of John's Gospel. There's 20 chapters. It's probably a 20 or 30 page read. But John says this, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah." Messiah is the Hebrew word for, same word as Christ in the Greek, meaning God's great king. "That Jesus is the Messiah, the king, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." John's saying, you believe the words of Jesus and trust him, you can find forgiveness, you can know God, you can have the promise of eternal life. And so, what would I say to Anthony Flew or to my friend who asked? God did turn up. He lived among us, and he's still making himself known through his words, which is the way that you know any person. And the promise is, God says, actually, if anyone looks for him and trusts his words, God's spirit will be at work in your life to bring these things, to make these things real for you. I think in a little while, Chris can tell you, if you're interested, to read John's Gospel. It's not a hard read. The language is fairly simple. It's just profound ideas. The word one-to-one is John's Gospel kind of walking you through that in bite-sized chunks. And so it's good to actually sit down with someone else even and read it and discuss it. How could that happen? Well, Chris will tell us in just a moment. Now, do we have time? We've got time for questions and so on. I'm in your hands, Chris. What do you want to do?
Yep.
Questions, comments?
I'm sure there are any questions of...
Well, there might be old school questions like...
Yes.
As long as I can say I don't know, I'm happy for any questions.
Sure. Well, thank you, firstly. You've given us lots of food for thought. Particularly, I was interested in what you said about the fact that, well, Christmas is about you, that can you know the mind behind the universe?
Mm.
And there's the nature of the universe, that it's like we've won the lottery. It's very much in a Goldilocks kind of situation here with the Earth and the solar system. We heard a bit about multiverses and the fine-tuning argument. Not the usual stuff you talk about at Christmas. John 1 as God's executive summary, that we can know God through Jesus. Where is God? Well, he turned up. He turned up a couple of thousand years ago. So what then... in summary, is the unexpected Christmas story?
that it really happened. And that it reaches out and touches our lives, can reach out and touch our lives in a very real way today. And it's deeper than just Santa Claus and half a dozen elves. No, that's a bad thing. I have grandkids, that's great fun. But there's real deep significant ideas here to wrestle with.
Do you have any questions from the floor?
Yeah, so you mentioned quite a few people who have thought really deeply about the world, the universe, everything. And some of these guys have come to the conclusion that maybe there is something out there. What about, for those guys that are out there that are still firmly believing there's nothing out there?
Mm.
What is it that stops them from making that leap? Well, not a leap, but like really understanding that God is real.
The politically correct answer would be that each person has to weigh this up and make their own decision for themselves, okay? And that is true. And that's all at City Bible Fund, that's all we're ever asking you to do. Would you like to have a look at the Bible and perhaps the evidence behind it and then weigh that up for yourself? Jesus would push further, though, because he's never politically correct, and say there's actually, at the heart of it, there is an unwillingness to accept that our Creator has the right to tell us how we should live and we should respond to him in thankfulness and obedience. And that makes some people bristle. So Christopher Hitchens, who... I'm really sorry that he got cancer. The reason I laugh is that he's such a scary debater. I've listened to him debate. I would not have wanted to debate him. And he played the game so hard. But his main argument was, I don't like the Christian faith because it's like a celestial North Korea with God looking over your shoulder all the time. Okay. But I would have said to him, and he's so much smarter than me, but I would have humbly said to him, that's not an argument. That's just saying, I don't like it. And I can say, I don't like the fact that Scott Morrison is Prime Minister. It doesn't change that Scott Morrison's Prime Minister. He just says, I don't like it. So Christopher Hitchens' main argument was, I don't like the idea of God being able to tell me what to do. Okay, but don't tell me anything about God or reality. So I think it's a matter of the heart. And are you prepared actually to admit that you're a creature and that your Creator knows what's best for you? Now, I say that respectfully, and I know that'll get up the nose of a lot of people, but I think that's part of what... Or the other one, if I could say, I've got a few people in my family who I love dearly and are not following Jesus. The reason I think that they're not is that they feel like they'd miss out if they did. There'd be things that they'd be able to do or want to do or whatever, and Jesus would pull them away from that. So there's a couple of possible reasons. Yeah. Yes?
Hi, Al. Thank you for sharing today. You've spoken a lot about us perhaps trying to get to know the divine, to get to know God. Would it be fair to say that God actually wants to get to know us?
Yes. Yes, that's a great... would it be fair, if you didn't hear that, I've talked about us getting to know the divine, would it be fair to say that God wants to get to know us? Yes, that's a brilliant, brilliant comment. So much of Jesus' teaching is about God through Jesus or God through the prophets taking the initiative to chase and to find people and to be at work in their lives. So in Luke chapter 15, Jesus' great parable about the shepherd who has 99 sheep, 100 sheep, loses one, goes looking for the lost sheep, finds it, and then there's a great party because he found the one that's lost. And Jesus was often saying that people are lost without God and he's come to find them. Yeah, so very good. Yes?
I have someone that asked me this question. I didn't know how to really respond. So the question was he believes that there's a God, but then Jesus is only like another manifestation of another God.
So like in like Hinduism, for example, there are a lot of gods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
God is God, Father, God, Holy Spirit, Jesus.
Yep.
Which is sort of like that concept of manifestation.
Mm.
But so then, how do you respond?
Okay. That's a good question, isn't it? Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. First one is respectfully. Okay. Got to respect other people's beliefs. And so I would say, it's not my authority, but let me try and tell you how the Bible or Jesus would answer that question, okay? I think as you look at the world, the vast majority of humanity is wired up for some kind of spiritual belief. It's very, very hard to live, and I say this respectfully, I think it's very hard to live as a hardcore atheist saying there's nothing, we're all just going to die and that's it. It's very hard to live that out in terms of the kind of the nihilism or nihilism that comes, etc. So there have been so many different, if you like, variations on trying to find the spiritual and that, etc., beyond just us. Now, the claim of Jesus is, of the Bible is, that the one creator, there is a spiritual world with spiritual beings. But the overall creator, the capital G God, has come and manifested himself in a time and a place, and sometimes it's called the scandal of the particular. So Jesus was with us for 33, 34 years, whatever it was, and then now he's gone. But he manifested himself through Jesus. Now, why accept that rather than the beliefs of Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam, etc.? Well, the New Testament claim is that it's anchored in history, in the birth, life, teaching, death, and the resurrection of Jesus. And the New Testament writers are claiming if these events really happened, then you've got to take the claims of Jesus seriously. And Jesus says, not me, okay, I'm passing the buck to him. Jesus says he's the only way to know God and the only way to find forgiveness. Now, that is a very sharp edge on it. And the sharp edge being, he can be right and everyone else wrong, or everyone else can be right and he can be wrong, but he will not let you fold him into the whole collection of different religions. He's over there on his own. He's either right or he's not. And so it does come down to, did those historical events happen? And that's if you like, ground zero in understanding the New Testament. Then what Jesus promises, if you'll come to his words with an open heart, his spirit will be at work in your life and open your eyes to see the truth. That's his claim. Okay. So now, I think you can say that to someone from another belief system respectfully, and they can weigh that up. I think that's the case. Now, big question though, did those historical events happen? Can we trust the Gospels? Peter J. Williams. I just bought this on Booktopia during the week. I haven't got to read this one yet. It only arrived 2 days ago. There's another one called The Christ Files by John Dixon. Brilliant little summary. If you're interested, just write that on your feedback form.
Yeah.
So that's how I guess you think about that. Right. Yeah. Sorry, long answer, but important question.